This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Sorry to disappoint,
but AT&T says the era of truly unlimited data plans is over.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Friday, March 2nd.
Coming up, the high and rising costs of renting.
The surprisingly heated debate over the dollar coin.
Plus, why you might want to plan a little extra time at the airport tomorrow morning.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Sorry to break the news, but it's the end of the line for truly unlimited data on your AT&T phone, even for folks who are grandfathered in. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Ginzer reports.
AT&T stopped offering unlimited data plans 2 years ago, but people who already had them got to keep them, so they could download movies and play video games on their phones to their heart's content. Fran Caulfield is a telecom analyst at Insight Research.
And so there could be people that, you know, get all their video watching done through their mobile phone or their tablet, but the network gets taxed when you do that for many hours over the course of the month.
AT&T says those heavy users were overloading its wireless network, so it had to do something. The company says these customers still have all-you-can-eat data plans. It's just all-you-can-eat slowly. And the company says only about 5% of its customers in a given area are affected. But those 5% are really mad. Some say their phones slow down so much they're practically useless. AT&T says they can either upgrade to a more expensive data plan or switch to a plan where more data costs more. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Ginzer for Marketplace.
And for more on this story, let's bring in Marketplace Tech Report host John Moe. Hi, John.
Good morning.
So why is AT&T doing this?
Well, the company line is that they want to slow down the people who are consuming a lot of data, the data hogs, as they're commonly referred to, by doing this thing called throttling, which is to slow down the data after a certain point to kind of ease up work on the network. You know, the other argument is that they're trying to move people out of this unlimited all-you-can-eat plan and into a tiered plan where they can make a little bit more money off those same people.
Why don't they just add more capacity?
Well, they tried, but the broadcast spectrum is a tricky thing, and they tried to do that with the acquisition of T-Mobile, and obviously that didn't work out.
Are the other phone companies going to do the same thing as AT&T is doing?
Well, T-Mobile already is, and they've made no secret about that. There's been some speculation, some independent testing that Verizon slows down unlimited customers after they reach a certain data point while not slowing down customers who use just as much data on a tiered plan. But you can see if you turn on the TV lately, at least for me, Sprint is running a bunch of ads saying unlimited means unlimited. Come over here. Come over to Big Yellow. It's all going to be fine. But one wonders how long even Sprint can keep that up.
All right. Well, I guess the big question, John, is this going to actually cause any AT&T customers to leave?
I think it could cause a lot of confusion and frustration if you don't know why it's slowing down. You can just say, well, this network isn't any good. I'm going to leave and go somewhere else. and so maybe it might cause a lot of people to leave, but it might cause people to run into the same problem if they go somewhere else. In the meantime, I think a lot of people are just going to say, yeah, I'll use Wi-Fi instead to do what I need to do.
John Moe, host of Marketplace Tech Report. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
The price of oil has reached fresh four-year highs this week after some reports about a pipeline explosion in Saudi Arabia, which the Saudis then said was not the case. Either way you look at it, though, the prices are high, the traders are on edge, and gas prices are obviously following oil prices right up there. Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial. He's with us from New York, as he is every Friday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Chris, whatever we're going to blame the rising prices on, they are high. They do appear to be staying that way for now. How worried are you about this and whether it's going to derail our recovery?
I don't think it's going to derail the recovery, but what it will do is almost certainly slow it down. We've only ever seen gas prices at current levels twice, and both times consumer spending slowed significantly. What worries me is that in the last 3 months, after adjusting for inflation, there is no growth in consumer spending at all, which tells you that people are already feeling strapped. And they'll feel even worse if gas prices go higher this spring.
Now, of course, we've had oil shocks before, recently and long ago. Are we better prepared at all this time than we were last time?
Well, that is one piece of good news. Actually, consumption of gasoline dropped significantly last year. And it's pretty clearly tied to an increase in average fuel mileage. So even when price relief came last fall, people still focused on buying cars that got good mileage, and that is going to pay off, make it a little bit easier.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks as always.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, inflation is chewing away at the money we make. We got consumer income and spending data yesterday showing a small increase in paychecks. But gas, as you just mentioned, Jeremy, and rent costs, they just ate those increases up. Mm. The rental market is booming. Folks who might have bought before the housing bubble are scared. Some wannabe buyers are unable to get loans. And people who are getting back to work as the economy improves, they want to move out of their parents' basement. From where we go to Faith Hope Consolo. She's with Prudential Douglas Elliman. Good morning.
Good morning.
So where's the rental market going from here?
It's been going up. It's been a very buoyant market. I suspect that we're going to be meeting demand for new space, new residential development in the next quarter as well.
Do you think the demand for rentals is going to keep growing?
Oh, yes. We've seen that as the pattern in the last 5 years. Who will not purchase or will not be able to purchase? And the rental market meets that. And for the students that graduate, people that relocate from one city to another corporately until they're able to purchase. So that's a 2 or 3 year demand ongoing.
So who's out there right now thinking about how to help or house these renters right now?
The developers have been watching this. They in Miami, Washington, D.C., Dallas, they've already geared up for new construction. And I think they're just moving forward. I mean, they were almost at a standstill, but there is money for construction out there. And some of the projects that had stopped have completely restarted, which means that we should be able to fill a lot of that demand by year end.
Faith Hope Consolo, thanks.
My pleasure.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Now to the global perspective on business and economics.
First to Europe, where we may be approaching a showdown between the European Union and Google over the website's new privacy policy. One of the EU's most senior officials says the new policy breaks European law. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Google's new privacy policy has raised hackles among users on both sides of the pond. Personal data the company collects through one of its services, like Gmail, will now be shared with all the others, like YouTube. In the US, 37 state attorneys general have expressed their alarm about this new approach. Now Vivian Redding, the EU's Justice Commissioner, has gone further. She told the BBC she believes this is illegal under European law.
We have European rules which say very clearly that the data of the individual belongs to the individual, and it is the individual who decides what happens with this data and not a company.
Google claims that its new policy is not illegal and will provide more relevant search results. The company adds that anyone can avoid targeted advertising by not logging into Google services. But Google must be worried. The last big US computer company to fall foul of European law was Microsoft, and it was slapped with one of the largest ever EU fines, more than $1 billion. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
In Russia this weekend, it's Putin versus the billionaire. Russians are going to vote on Sunday in the country's sixth ever presidential election since independence in 1991. Prime Minister Vladimir Putin is leading in the polls, and three of his challengers have lost to him in the past. The fourth challenger is Mikhail Prokhorov. He's one of Russia's richest men and the owner of the New Jersey Nets basketball team. Peter Van Dyke has more from Moscow.
On a freezing Moscow day, folk musicians belt out traditional songs at a campaign event, but the candidate people are waiting for is anything but traditional. Mikhail Prokhorov has a smartphone app, is worth $18 billion, and is better known for late-night parties than political ones. Being one of Russia's mega-rich can make life easy, but not if you're running for political office, says Denis Volkov of the independent polling agency, the Levada Center.
The majority of population is very critical about big business.
Many Russians loathe men like Prokhorov, who became super rich when Russia's natural resources were privatized in the 1990s. But here in Moscow, wealth isn't such a problem. In the capital, Prokhorov is polling second behind Vladimir Putin. The billionaire fields questions for almost 2 hours.
I think he generally speaks about improving the overall business environment.
Ivan Chikirov of Renaissance Capital Investment Bank.
This is something that, or the key thing that many foreign investors are complaining about when they refer to Russia. So I think this is a worthy goal.
It also sounds good to Vera Davina, a middle-aged mom who runs her own small internet trading business.
He's a political novice, but maybe some of his ideas about effectively managing a business will lead to effective policies.
While Prokhorov's outlook comes from his business background, Davina says, Putin's comes from his time in the KGB. Prokhorov repeatedly says he will do what's best for Russia because his life is sorted. For starters, he says he'll give 17 of his $18 billion to charity. That's if he's elected. But with polls indicating strong support for Vladimir Putin, Prokhorov's generosity may not be put to the test. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
Now on to the creation of the world's largest airline, the merger between United and Continental. Late tonight, the two reservation systems will be integrated. In time, they promise for East Coast travelers to check in for Saturday flights. But marrying all that data, the names, the flights, the credit card info, the frequent flyer miles, is complicated and expensive. Marketplace's Sally Herships reports.
The reservation systems for big airlines like Continental and United are complex. Robert Mann, an analyst for the industry, uses the term man years instead of man hours to describe how much work it takes to merge systems like these.
These tasks have been going on for upwards of 18 months in some cases.
Continental says it's been training United employees, 15,000 of them since last fall, in how to use its system. Mann says the costs for these switchovers can run into the millions.
It's a big deal because it not only includes the reservation that you made, but it includes any changes to the reservation that you've made, including
seat assignments or special meal requests. And airlines use their reservation systems to make what's called a weight and balance calculation. Mann says planes aren't allowed to take off without it. But he says customers flying United this weekend shouldn't have any reservations about their reservations. Though, just in case, he says, be sure to print out your boarding pass at home. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Well, today in L.A., it's probably going to be in the 70s or something, Adrian.
Something
usually it
pleasant.
Is, right? But it's going to be 60 degrees in Washington, D.C. It's going to be 76 in Memphis, which is just a continuation of this very mild winter that has been happening across the country. And it turns out that's been pretty good for the economy. It's helping retail sales and employment in cities across the U.S., one of them being Cleveland. From WCPN, Brian Bull reports.
Dan Lenahan normally takes a two-week vacation to Florida every winter. But the builder and contractor has been too busy so far this year. He says calls have been steadily coming in for roofing, garages, additions, and other projects that normally would have had to wait until the spring thaw.
We haven't really had a deep freeze all winter. We were actually in the ground, we were working, and we were able to use the excavator.
It's amazing what can be done when you're not contending with minus 30 wind chill and snowdrifts up to your waist. But while builders are happy with the balmy spell, others are feeling the chill of unsold goods. Danielle Debo is co-owner of the clothing store Dredgers Union. She says she's stuck with dozens of coats, scarves, and hats.
You buy those items 8 months in advance, so you're anticipating that as a Cleveland, Ohio-based store, you can pretty much count on a full-blown winter.
But Debo says there is a bright side. The warm weather has brought more foot traffic to her store. In Cleveland, I'm Brian Bull for Marketplace.
And Jeremy, here in California, all right, we might not have the exclusive on the warm weather, but yep, there's going to be something else that only we have.
Oh, okay, what's that?
A cupcake vending machine.
Finally.
A pink cupcake vending machine. According to the LA Times, it will dispense freshly baked cupcakes from Sprinkles Bakery. I'm imagining sort of a smush cupcake, though, when it drops to the bottom.
How do they stay intact?
Or maybe one that's like pushed up against the side that just won't fall and you're shaking. Hopefully they figured out a better way.
The U.S. economy is still fragile, of course, but there are signs of improvement. Here's Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke in his testimony to a Senate committee yesterday.
We don't see at this point that the very severe recession has permanently affected the growth potential of the U.S. economy.
Job numbers are up, the market keeps chugging ahead, and some economists credit President Obama's stimulus plan for that improvement. A new book by Noam Schreiber argues things would be even better if the White House had done even more. The book is called The Escape Artists, and Noam joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
The subtitle of your book is that President Obama fumbled the economic recovery. But today the Dow is near 13,000. Unemployment rate is the lowest it's been in 3 years. The auto industry is thriving. How is that fumbled?
I thought a lot about the subtitle for the book. And the general thought process was not a catastrophe. In fact, they did a very good job averting catastrophe. This could have been a depression, but it was a very long 3 years before this recovery actually picked up steam. And there were a number of mistakes made along the way, which I describe in the book.
Now, what are those mistakes that they made? What do you think?
The early mistake was aiming a little too low on the initial stimulus. Now, the suggestion isn't that had they just come out for $1.8 trillion stimulus that they would have gotten it. But I think if you understand better that you're dealing with that size of hole, you want to aim on the high side rather than the low side. And then over the next couple of years, there was a real stalemate within the administration over whether you pursue deficit reduction. And another group of advisors who thought, really, we've not done enough to stimulate this economy, and we need to do more. These two camps kind of were at each other's throats for a long period of time, and it resulted in stasis and stalemate, and they really never got their act together. And I think that was very costly. The president himself was very frustrated by that.
What do you make of the president's other recent policy proposals?
Well, I think that two things are clear. One, that he wants to introduce more fairness. He wants affluent people to pay their fair share and does not feel like they've been doing that. And two, he realizes that we have a kind of long-term fiscal problem, and he realizes that we need to fix that. And on that, he's been less specific, but I don't necessarily blame him because everything is kind of subject to what happens in November with the presidential election.
Noam Schreiber is author of The Escape Artists. Thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, Adrian, this morning we counted up the staff's money in the marketplace office.
At least our dollar bills.
Our dollar bills. And I asked, how many dollar bills do you have? And between all of us, we had 14 $1 bills. Not, you know, counting all the hundreds that you keep in your wallet at all times.
Right.
But just the $1 bills. We had 14 of them altogether. Zero $1 coins.
Yeah, I haven't had a dollar coin in a long time.
Not in a long time. Well, that's something that Republican Senator John McCain and Democratic Senator Tom Harkin would like to change. They want to replace the dollar bill with a dollar coin, and they've introduced some legislation, a bill, if you will, to do that. And they say it would save a couple hundred million dollars a year. Senator Harkin joins us now from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, why do you want to get rid of the dollar bill and replace it with a coin?
Well, for a lot of reasons, not the least of which it will save us money. The GAO, the Government Accountability Office, has examined this 6 times, 1990, 93, 95, 2000, 2011, and 2012, and every time they reached the same conclusion. Basically, we should transition from the dollar bill and move to a dollar coin.
And every time Americans don't seem to be on board with that, and they are given the opportunity to have dollar coins, but they don't want them.
Well, that's because we keep the dollar bill in circulation. If we didn't have the dollar bill in circulation, people would get used to the coins. Every modern economy in the world has made this switch to higher denomination coins.
Well, Senator, let me ask you this. I mean, when you go to Europe or Canada or someplace that does use dollar coins or whatever their currency is, and they have coin denominations, do you get annoyed by having 10 $1 coins in your pocket?
No, because I took a vacation in Canada last summer, and quite frankly, I found having the $2 coin much better than going around with a lot of dollar bills. And it didn't bother me a bit. In fact, most countries, you go to Japan, they have a 500 yen coin that's worth about $6, $6 US. Of course, there's the 2 pound coin in the United Kingdom. That's worth about $3 in America. So I didn't find it burdensome at all.
And of course, one of the other things that people mention in favor of coins over dollar bills is that the blind are able to use them in an easier way than trying to figure out what it says on the paper dollar bill.
No doubt about it. People who have sight problems can use coins a lot better than bills. Here's one other thing I think that people aren't focusing on, Jeremy, and that is that every year the government disposes of 15.2 million pounds of paper currency every year. Hmm. Yet a coin is 100% recyclable. So environmentalists ought to be for this. A coin, 100% recyclable. However, we destroy 15 million pounds of paper currency every year.
Well, then why do you think there's so much opposition?
Well, there's opposition from places where they make the paper for the dollar bill. There's opposition from the ink manufacturers that make the ink for the dollar bill, and on and on. I think the facts and the data and logic and reason are on the side of moving to a dollar coin.
So what do you think is going to happen? When will you be able to get this bill through, do you think?
We're going to continue to push on this. We have good bipartisan support, as you know, both Republicans and Democrats. But just to get the facts out to the public about how much money it will save us and that it will make it much easier for large retail stores, vending machines, transit agencies, all the arguments on the side of moving towards a coin. But then again, sometimes logical arguments don't always win in the United States Congress.
Well, Senator, have you been using the dollar coins that are already in circulation?
Yes, I do. It's hard to find them sometimes. I mean, you almost have to ask for them. And then the cashier will fumble around and they don't have them.
They always seem to have them on the Amtrak trains.
Well, good point.
There's a good place to find them. Senator Tom Harkin is a Democrat of Iowa who has sponsored a bill that would replace the dollar bill eventually with dollar coins. Senator, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
Now it's your turn. All morning long, we've been asking for your opinion on coins versus bills. And in today's Midday Extra, we're going to read a few of your responses. First up, the problem with coins when it comes to tips.
Yeah, Michelle Alexander wrote, "I don't need the weight of coin in my purse, pockets, etc. Bad for the back."
That's a lot of money you're carrying around,
I guess,
though.
So.
Another big concern about coins we heard, they fall out of your pocket.
Yeah, Kenneth Dupuy writes, "Not that I use cash very much, but there's nothing like sitting on a sofa in Europe and having €8 end up under the cushion." That's true.
And when you think you've got money for that coffee in your pocket and it's no longer there.
It's no longer there.
Frustrating.
Sitting on the couch. Plus, the coins can be noisy, Adrian.
Yep. We heard from Maureen Franklin, who says she's for the bill. Thieves cannot hear paper in her pocket.
Of course, not everyone is a coin hater who has come to our Facebook page and our website this morning. Alberto Zuniga writes, "Coins, absolutely. It's kind of ridiculous that we haven't made the switch yet. Are we in some sort of a competition to be the last industrialized nation to use a dollar bill?"
And one more opinion here from Linda Harlow. She says, "Neither one stays in my wallet long enough to matter."
That's probably a good point.
I can identify with it.
Well, what do you think? We want to hear from you. Just go to our APM Marketplace Facebook page and let us know. Or you can go to our website, marketplace.org, find the story that has to do with dollar coins and dollar bills, and comment on it.
In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.